BioInsights podcast.
Hello, I'm David McCall, Commissioning Editor of Cell and Gene Therapy Insights, and welcome to a four-part series exploring a question that the entire cell and gene therapy community is struggling with at the moment. Where will tomorrow's workforce come from? The cell and gene therapy field has been advancing at a breakneck speed for the best part of a decade now, fueled by long-awaited clinical successes, commercial breakthroughs, and a related startling increase in activity from both investors and big pharma. But with this relentless pace of growth and innovation comes the fundamental challenge of developing a sufficiently large and skilled workforce to support and maintain the sector. In episode 2, we look predominantly at how the educational system is evolving to meet the specific training and skills requirements of the burgeoning advanced therapies field. In this third episode, we turn the spotlight onto the cell and gene therapy industry and how it is approaching staff development and retention, a crucial area that's been made all the more challenging by the current high level of competition for talent in the field, as well as the evolving mindset of workers relating to their career development and pathway that has been wrought by the COVID-19 pandemic, among other things. So, what are the keys to ensuring a cell and gene therapy company can keep hold of its brightest stars and help them to flourish and grow? Let's look firstly at where the recruitment opportunity, but also the competition for skilled workers, are both at their greatest. Biotech hubs. Here's Michael Lemke from the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine on why both established and new biotech hubs are so critically important to the continued development of the field and its workforce.
I think that in the US, talent has initially been drawn from local biotech hubs, such as Boston and San Francisco, well-known hubs. And this tends to be very expensive and is still true to a large extent, but there are also new cell and gene therapy hubs emerging. I think Philadelphia is a great example of that. And we're also, as these therapies are moving towards commercialization, seeing the importance of biomanufacturing hubs in some cases, which already have an existing trained workforce. And RTP in North Carolina would be a great example of that. New Jersey, and more recently, even places like Columbus, Ohio. One specific example or story I can share, ViralGen, who is a CDMO, a viral vector manufacturer, an affiliate of Bayer. They're located in San Sebastian, Spain, a relatively young and small company. And very early on, they realized that it was going to be difficult for them to bring in the talent that they needed for manufacturing from other countries or even other regions within Spain. Also recognized that there was a need, a workforce development need in Spain, where, unemployment has been quite high in recent years. So they spent a fair amount of effort advocating for the importance of cell and gene therapy manufacturing with local and regional government authorities. And what they found when they built those relationships was that the local and regional governments were able to support them in making connections to professional schools and universities. And they really opened some doors. And this ultimately led to a great solution with an accredited training program in biotechnology manufacturing, which has both classroom and hands-on as part of the curricula. Since 2020, they've graduated 50 individuals from that program, and they have a class of 28 at ViralGen right now, working on the hands-on part of the two-year curricula. So this has really fed ViralGen's workforce needs, but also created locally above-average wages and high-tech jobs for the area.
That is a great example of how a biotech hub can get its start through the collaboration of industry, academia, and public sector. However, it's not all plain sailing for new and emerging hubs, and that's in large part due to competition for workforce between the hubs themselves. Dr. Sven Kili, CEO of Swiss biotech Antion Biosciences, explains.
In general, the EU is a lot more distributed, so that there is slightly less shortage in biotech centres like London and the environs around London. But if you go, speaking specifically to the UK, up into the north of the UK, or to certain EU countries that are really not considered typical biotech hubs, there absolutely is a shortage. And it's these areas where the training need is so much more obviously high, because these non-hub areas, if I can call them that, are really working to attract these companies because of the money and the expertise they bring in. But those companies are struggling to hire the expertise that's actually required to allow those companies to flourish. And so you almost have a catch-22 situation there. We're also seeing a similar picture in the US, where there is a relative increase in the biotech hubs of Boston, Philadelphia, and San Francisco, but other areas tend to struggle a little bit more. And so it's a similar kind of thing where if you are a very new biotech, you may choose to set up in a city or an area that is rather cheaper in terms of rental, et cetera, but then you pay the price of struggling to hire the appropriately skilled people. And so you then have to pay to bring them in. And the challenge then is, do they want to move? Because if they find out the pot at the bottom of your company is not filled with as much gold as the other companies, they may find themselves having to move back to one of those hubs. So it becomes a slightly difficult situation to be in.
Here's Dr. James Miskin, Chief Technology Officer of Oxford Biomedica, on the challenges that competitive biotech hub environments present in terms of staff recruitment and retention.
I think in the US in particular, in hubs like Boston, San Francisco, and so on, there is an employment market, which means that individuals can move very readily between businesses, which from a attracting talent perspective is a good thing, but from a retaining talent perspective is quite a challenge. And I would say that's another area where, you know, maybe different employment rights and the culture of the business basically becomes absolutely crucial for you to attract and then retain the skills that you need within the business. We're now a relatively large employer. We've got 800 plus people working for us. And I think it is incumbent on us as a relatively large player in cell and gene biologics development manufacturing to engage in outreach activities, to engage in public sort of opportunities, if you like, to talk to people about the opportunities that there are in the sector. We're trying to set up a way of working that encourages things like internships to happen regularly. You know, we're occasionally able to do work experience. Obviously, with COVID, that's been very difficult. And I think we're not alone in not really having satisfactorily, to my satisfaction anyway, having a work experience program for school-age children in the sort of 15 to 18 range. But that's important.
So what are some of the key aspects of and approaches to staff retention and development that cell and gene therapy companies should consider? Here's Sven Keeley.
I think offering options for additional training and progression is very, very important, particularly with the huge expansion of companies and the requirement to bring people in from other industries, from other training, etc., being able to give them a much better view into the cell and gene therapy space and help them understand where their own career can go and how that can develop, not just in a straight line, but potentially at tangents. In general, the type of people that I've liked to hire, this type of approach tends to appeal to them because they can really grow their skills, allowing them to participate in skills groups. So a variety of the organizations that we work with, including ISCT, ASGCT, the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, a standards coordinating body, et cetera, have skills groups where they have people that have specific skills, and they can then participate in those and interact with people from other companies, regulators, and academia in that similar area. And that allows them to have a much broader view on the job that they're doing. This type of approach is also being very well executed by the Bioindustry Association Manufacturing Advisory Committee. And what the Manufacturing Advisory Committee have done for a number of years now, they've created a group of early professionals who participate in regular meetings and even visit participating manufacturing sites. So not only do they get exposure to new and different approaches within the manufacturing, they also grow their network. And I think this has been extremely popular and has been very, very efficient in really growing the space. And so within the UCL MSc program that I help to run, we're doing a similar thing in that we are allowing the students a number of times a year to actually visit some of the manufacturing facilities and other facilities that are associated with the space to give them that view on where they can go and what the areas are for them to go forward. And this hopefully helps them to stay engaged in the space and to learn more.
Emily Hopewell is an assistant professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, where she leads the cell and gene therapy manufacturing facility. Here are her thoughts on staff engagement and development and the importance of aligning these strategies with the characteristics and expectations of a new generation of cell and gene therapy sector professionals.
One of our short-term goals is really to have a robust training program for our new hires so that we can get them contributing to the team as quickly as possible. In my past experience, that also helps increase their engagement and increase job satisfaction. So even if they do decide to go on to a different position through industry or even medical school, we have a number of people who do that or graduate school, we can maybe keep them happy a little bit longer and they will be more likely to contribute. It's an interesting topic. I have small children and I look at what they are learning in school today versus what I learned. So I think the challenge, right, at least what I see, there's so much information available to everyone now. And, you know, most people can't be experts in everything, but we have developed such, I guess my personal opinion is that our culture has come to a point where we, if we have questions, we move on to the next thing. We find the information out, we keep moving. It can be challenging because when we are manufacturing gene therapy or cell therapy products, you have to be willing to pay close attention to detail, even if you're doing something relatively redundant. There is massive multitasking now. You see it, I see it everywhere. Everywhere I go, if people are, you know, they're talking on the phone, walking down while they're doing their grocery shopping, or they're texting while they're having a conversation with a friend. And so it's hard to me, I see that as a challenge, how to keep the younger generation who come in as new hires, especially new grads, how to keep them engaged in what they're doing and give them enough flexibility so that they aren't required to do the same task over and over and over and over again. Because I think the other thing that I have seen just in even in recent years is that a lot of the newer hires that are fresh out of college, they're one of the first questions they ask is, what's my promotion schedule? You know, what do I need to do to get to the next step? And when I started out in cell therapy 2 decades ago-ish, I was looking at things going, okay, well, I'm the low man on the totem pole. No one here is going to be retiring for any time, you know, anytime in the near future. So I need to decide if I'm going to be content where I'm at, or if I'm going to do something about it and get my education and move forward that way. And so I think that that is a challenge. So how do we build this so that we can keep people happy? And what we've tried to institute where I was previously, as well as where I am now, are career progressions that have very specific goals that staff have to reach. And we can say, okay, you're going to move, you know, you're starting out as a trainee because you have no experience. Within that year, if you meet all those requirements, you can move up to the next level. It gets a little bit harder as you move forward. But if we can catch them and keep them within that year or so, we can get a lot more out of them.
James Miskin agrees that a strong focus on development and demonstrating a clear pathway for career progression reaps dividends, both for the cell and gene therapy company and for the individual staff member.
For me, one of the challenges we have is, you know, we've got a very good reputation in terms of upskilling and training individuals. So we bring people into the business, say they're graduate level, and within the sort of first 12 to 18 months, they learn a hell of a lot of new stuff. that they didn't get from their degree. I mean, a degree level qualification is a good baseline, but it isn't sort of a qualification that allows you to get started in a job and be productive and effective in that role straight away. So that investment, that early investment in those individuals, I think one of our challenges is to make people feel like they're being invested in. I think there is an expectation that people will move on through their career very quickly. And because of the competition, because of the skills gap, if you like, the skill shortage, it's relatively easy for people to up sticks and move. And sometimes that's the right thing to do for an individual, but oftentimes sticking it out a little bit longer and giving your employer an opportunity to sort of move you through the career pathway within your chosen area of the business is very possibly the right thing to do. You know, we have had quite a few people return to Oxford Biomedica after taking a sabbatical in another business. And I would say that's a good thing.
Here's Sven Keeley on the importance of evolving employer practices and attitudes towards staff to reflect the changing needs and priorities of the workforce.
I think other areas that we also consider that are related to various retention mechanisms include lifestyle and family-related approaches. Speaking to some HR gurus recently, and also as I'm currently hiring, there is much more of an emphasis on quality of life, whereas in the old days, it was how many hours can you work? Now it's more about how efficient and how can you optimize your lifestyle and your work-life balance. And so we're starting to think much more holistically about our employees, that they're not just someone there to do a job, but they're actually a human being who's contributing not only to the job, but to the value and the ethos of the company. And so there are, you know, things like no limits on holidays, parking spaces, transport vouchers, lifestyle benefits, and other things that are also coming in and are being found very, very useful to support retention of employees in association with the ability to develop professionally in a variety of mechanisms that I've already touched on.
Finally, I asked our industry experts to share some do's and don'ts with regard to staff development and retention. Here's James Miskin.
The other thing I think you absolutely do need to do is maintain a strong culture within the business where people feel absolutely passionately about the job that they do. That's important because, you know, on a day-to-day basis, oftentimes it feels quite repetitive. There are repetitive tasks that need to be done in Cell and Gene. It's not all, you know, saving people's lives firsthand, but all the pieces plugged together end up in saving people's lives. And so communicating that message is crucial. And I'm not sure we've got it right yet. I think just trying to get that balance of encouragement and opportunity for individuals, but at the same time, not making it so it's actually not effective for us as an employer, because ultimately we've got jobs that need doing. And I would say pretty much every other company has got that as well. So the grass is not always greener on the other side of the fence is the way I would like to look at it. And we need to be just as good, ideally better than our direct competitors, such that the general influx of skills and talent is a positive one for us as a business.
Sven Keeley.
I think some of the key must-not-dos is must not treat people as drones. So I turn it into must-dos, and things like treating any potential and existing employees with honesty and respect. I think this is one of the big areas where the biotech and the pharmaceutical industry has struggled in a number of years ago in terms of that companies haven't exactly been honest with employees and with customers. And so I think this is critically important, even more so in smaller companies. Things are heard, secrets are tough to keep. And so involving teams in what's happening, especially as it relates to their future, is really important. So the must not do's are really don't not communicate. Ensure that, you know, people are communicated with, they're involved. especially smaller companies, your hierarchy is very often quite dangerous. And it's about treating people as individuals, and everybody is a critical component of the success of your company. So whether they clean the floors, clean the toilets, culture the cells, sell the product, or manage the entire process, it doesn't really matter. The criticals are to keep everyone involved and be honest and open with them at all times.
We've heard from several of our contributors about the importance of understanding the needs and motivations of the next generation of cell and gene therapy workers. I asked Dr. Kazim Rafiq, Associate Professor of Cell and Gene Therapy Bioprocess Engineering at University College London, about the students currently being educated at UCL. Who are they, and how do they differ from previous generations in terms of their work practices, natural areas of expertise, and philosophies on career?
I think students are certainly, I think, much more aware of the opportunities that they have available to them. I think, obviously, when I was an undergrad, I'm not saying we didn't have access to the internet. We certainly had access to the internet. This is kind of early mid-2000s, but it wasn't clear about the roles and opportunities that were available within the industry, not just the availability of roles, but also I think the types of things that were available, so kind of the roles that you'd be doing and what that work would entail and involve. And I think students and you know, particularly undergraduate students, are far more aware and up to date of what is actually available. And I think they're also aware of how much they're in demand. Now that's a good thing and a bad thing. Obviously, it's a good thing because, you know, it increases their motivation and their passion for the field and so on. And it gives them some drive to know that there are jobs available in this industry. It's sometimes a bad thing because, you know, then there may be a sense of entitlement. You know, we know that there's jobs available, therefore, you know, we want to make sure that we are you know, going to, you know, demand X, Y, and Z because, you know, the industry needs us. And I think there's a fine balance within that. I want to make sure our students do get effectively remunerated and so on in line with industry standards. But at the same time, we want our students to really work the hard yards in order to get their stripes and develop their experience. Having said that, I also think that because of the transition in skills that are required, I think we are starting to see that the generation of new researchers or new scientists or engineers, whatever it might be, have got a broader multidisciplinary skill set. So, you know, we're starting to see some of our graduates who understand the basic science, but know how to do coding or programming. You know, that certainly wasn't the case maybe 15 years ago. And that's something that we want to encourage. I think we're also starting to, I'm talking now about UCL, we are emphasizing the need for our scientists and engineers to have that breadth of knowledge as well as that depth of knowledge. So they have to understand, for example, the steps required to establish a phase one or phase two or preclinical, the types of data packages that you would need, in addition to understanding the fundamentals around Reynolds number, which would be required within a stead tank bioreactor. So as well as having their core engineering knowledge, to have that appreciation of, okay, this is what is required if we're going to get this therapy onto the market. This is, you know, they may not need to know how the depth in those areas, but having that appreciation, knowledge and awareness and understanding is important because it will then dictate their early discussions with their colleagues in a company in the industry. Because they, you know, if we adopt this technology, it may lead to a particular increase or decrease in cost of goods, for example, or may improve our regulatory roadmap or pathway because, you know, it's an established technology. Those are the sorts of skills that we want the students to have, and we're starting to see the students come out with. I think finally, and this is society in general, we're starting to realize the importance of mental health and of kind of working not just within our limits, but working collectively and cohesively as a team to try and create a culture that is high performing, productive, but also one that is collaborative and so on. And that's something I'm seeing. Again, I can't comment how it was 20 years ago, but certainly during my time in undergraduate to what I see now, we're starting to see that, you know, teams achieve things. Individuals, you know, maybe 50, 70, 100 years ago could do things and do some amazing things, but now we're starting to see the real impact of multiple individuals working together for, you know, a common objective, delivering some phenomenal outputs that could never be delivered by a single individual. So that working together, working collaboratively, I think is something that, you know, I think has always been seen to be important, but now it's just, you know, increased. And I think, you know, the students are certainly recognizing that, and that is kind of part of their makeup, their DNA, and the goals to their individual and collective success.
Many thanks to Michael Lemke, Sven Keeley, James Miskin, Emily Hopewell, and Kazim Rafiq for contributing to this episode of the BioInsights podcast. Join us for the final episode in this series, when we will give the floor to the next generation, whom we've been discussing today, and ask them to explain their own philosophies, priorities, hopes, and aspirations as they embark on careers in the cell and gene therapy space.